Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We have been working our way verse by verse through the book of Luke. However, this morning we are starting in Matthew because we have been looking at all four of the gospel accounts of the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. We got as far the last couple of weeks as talking about the attributes of Christ's death on the cross. We're going to talk about a couple of the things here in Matthew, and then if we get to the resurrection this morning, which we may, we will then talk about the attributes of the resurrection. Because in Pauline theology, it was not just Christ's death that accomplished our complete salvation. It was his death, his burial, and his resurrection. There was a lot more going on in Paul's theology than just his death. And often in religion, his death is emphasized, as it was in like the Passion movie, far above the resurrection. The resurrection is the proof that the sacrifice of his body was accepted by the Father. If he had died and that sacrifice was not sufficient atonement, if he had died and the Father did not accept that work, then we're still in our sin and we still have no hope. But him coming up out of the grave was proof positive that God accepted the sacrifice that was on the cross 3 days earlier. So Pauline theology is that he was buried, he died for our offenses, for our sinfulness. He bore our sins on the cross. But then he says he was raised for our justification. So our justification is wrapped up in the fact that the Father fully accepted that sacrifice and we are now held as personally innocent. And so the resurrection has a lot of theology and promises attached to it as well. So we'll get into all of that. However, there's other narrative stuff and history stuff that we have to do to get there. So we may or may not get full on into the resurrection this morning. All right? I am in Matthew 27. And I think we got through verse 44. The only thing that's necessary to look at for a second to reiterate in Matthew 27:44 is the fact that there were two thieves, one on each side of him, that were crucified with him. And that in Matthew's account, it says the thieves also, which were crucified with him, cast the same in his teeth. In other words, as the Jews were castigating him on the cross, saying, if you are the Son of God, come down off that cross. A very interesting thing for them to say. It was the very fact that he was the Son of God that kept him on that cross. The one thing he could not do was get off that cross because he was the Son of God and he had to complete the process of saving his people. But according to Matthew, the thieves also, each of them on either side, were chiding him. And as we're going to see in Luke's account, it is one of the two thieves who stopped that chiding and actually took sides with Jesus and said, well, we're getting our just deserts. We're getting what we deserve, but he's innocent. He doesn't deserve this. And we'll get into that too. If both Matthew and Luke are harmonized, what you get is the idea that both thieves, when they were taken to the cross, were both joining in the chiding and the making fun of Jesus, but that one of them had a salvific experience. One of them had a conversion right there on the cross in recognizing who Christ was. And that thief on the cross is a great deal of comfort to a whole lot of people. I remember talking to my dad prior to his own death. I asked him, you know, are you worried about it? Are you worried about death? He had liver cancer. He knew he was dying. But at one point, he finally admitted that he was a little worried, a little scared. And he said, I don't think I know enough. And it was a great opportunity to go back and say to him, Dad, what did the thief on the cross know? He had no theology. He had no background. He had no history. He wasn't raised in the church. He couldn't get down and go be baptized. He couldn't go join a church. Couldn't go to the front and cry through a box of Kleenex or shake a preacher's hand. He really couldn't do anything. And yet, if there's anybody in the Bible that had a secure promise right from the lips of Jesus, today you will be with me in paradise. Before the sun is down, you and me together, paradise, that's the plan. That was the most secure. Wouldn't you love to have that statement? Isn't that a promise you'd love to hear from the lips of Jesus? So the thief had no knowledge of anything. He had no doctrine, he had no theology, he had no background. And I was able to say to my dad, he knew one thing. He knew one thing. He knew who to look to. He knew where salvation was. And it wasn't in a doctrine, and it wasn't in a theology, and it wasn't in a church membership, and it wasn't in any of the practices or the exercises that you can do in the church. It wasn't in his baptism, very important. It wasn't in anything other than he knew who to look to when he said, "When you come into your kingdom, remember me. Remember me." That's all he had to ask. And that was enough for Jesus to say, today. Meanwhile, the other thief on the other side, lost eternally. Got onto the cross, chiding Jesus, and lost eternally. And on the other side, a man who was lost till he saw Jesus. He saw Jesus and was saved and had the promise from Jesus that that day they'd be together in paradise. And if you get that image, if you get that picture, you've got Jesus hanging between the saved and the lost. And the ones who knew him are saved eternally, and the ones who don't are condemned eternally, and he is the deciding factor in all humanity between the saved and the lost. Even in his death, he continued to teach the same reality that he is the dividing factor in all of humanity. We'll get to that too. Because there's also sort of an Old Testament theological question that we have to ask, since we know that Jesus said 3 days and three nights he would be in the belly of the earth, and yet he said to the thief, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." You go, well, wait, if we're both in paradise today, but you're going to be in the belly of the earth for 3 days and three nights, how's that work? So we got to talk about that too. So there's a lot to talk about still. So now, verse 45, Matthew 27. "Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour." 3 hours of darkness from the sixth to the ninth hour. There's been a lot of conjecture about why that was. This was something that was not unprecedented. You know that during the time that the nation of Israel were in the Egyptian captivity, that when Moses started bringing plagues on Egypt in order to tell Pharaoh, "Let my people go so they can go into the wilderness and worship me," that there was a series of plagues, and one of the last of those plagues was a darkness that came for 3 days over all of Egypt. You want to talk about sovereignty for a moment. It was a darkness so deep that the people in Egypt wouldn't even get up off their beds. They wouldn't get up and go anywhere or do anything because they literally just couldn't see anything. So 3 days of darkness in all of Egypt except in Goshen, where the Israelites were all encamped. In Goshen, plenty of light, and they carry on with their lives, and they eat and drink and cook and go on with their lives. And so there's this area of light in the midst of this three-day darkness. Now, that's a very sovereign God. A God who can control light and dark to the degree that he can say darkness will come right up to here, and from here forward, light. And then light to here, and then dark again. So there is a precursor to this 3 hours of darkness in what happened in Egypt. When it says darkness, when you see it in the movies and stuff, it's just sort of cloudiness. It's like it gets overcast. I don't believe that it's just an overcast. If it had just become cloudy and overcast, it wouldn't have been worth the mention. I think it became that kind of dark, that kind of black dark, so much so that even the Roman centurion, who was there at the foot of the cross when the earthquakes came and everything else, said, "This surely is the Son of God." Well, he had to be convicted by more than just the fact that it got cloudy. It had to get really dark. A very common explanation for why the darkness came was because of Isaiah's description of Jesus on the cross and saying that the language in the King James is his visage, which means his physical body, was marred more than any man, that when God was pouring out 3 hours of wrath on the body of Christ, it wouldn't be right for man to be able to look on that. That it wouldn't be right for men to be able to look on God pouring out wrath on his Son, and that his body and his visage were so torn up and so ripped up by the wrath coming on him that God put a darkness over the whole thing. If you read commentaries about this passage, that's the most common explanation for the darkness, was to keep men from looking on the body of the Son of God as God buffeted him. But in the end, we don't really know beyond the fact that it happened. It became dark for 3 hours, so dark, I believe, that I think everybody in Israel had to just pause for 3 hours because middle of the day, dark, can't go anywhere, can't do anything, because the central focus of all mankind at that moment was what was happening out there in the place of the skull, and God darkened everything. 46, verse 46, "And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried in a loud voice, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani,' which is to say, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" Now, two views on that verse and on that statement. Why have you forsaken me? The word for forsaken in the Greek has at its root the idea of turning away or turning your back on. So as a consequence, as you read commentaries about that verse, you'll see a lot of people say that what Jesus was saying was that Jesus now becoming the embodiment of sin, having all our sin placed on him, that God, who is righteous and holy and cannot look on sin, turned his back on his Son, and that the Father and the Son, who had ever eternally been face to face, who had always been one, who had always been in unity, for the first time there was a disunity between them when God turned away from the Son, and that caused the Son to cry out. That's one theory on what is going on there. The second theory is that what Jesus was doing was beginning to quote Psalm 22, because that is the opening line of Psalm 22. So this morning we're going to turn to it and read Psalm 22, because it is one of the most messianic psalms to come off the pen of David. And you can see why, if Jesus were to have started quoting it, it would have rung a bell in the ears of all his Jewish hearers that were around the cross. They would have recognized that he was quoting David. And if they went back and looked at that psalm, they would have recognized all the things that were going on at that very moment. So let's read that psalm together. It's fairly long. Psalm 22, starting at verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's the exact same words that Jesus spoke on the cross. Why are you so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring? O my God, I cry in the daytime, but thou hearest not, and in the night season, and am not silent. But thou art holy, O thou that inhabits the praises of Israel. Verse 4, our fathers trusted in thee. They trusted, and thou delivered them. They cried unto thee and were delivered. They trusted in thee and they were not confounded. But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised of the people. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, he trusted on the Lord that he would deliver him. Let him deliver him, seeing he delighteth in him. Now, this is exactly what was happening at the cross. The Jews were walking at the foot of the cross and chiding Jesus. And so the theory is that when Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? The beginning of Psalm 22, that those Pharisees and those educated Jews that were around the cross would have heard that. And if they went back either by memory or went back and read Psalm 22, they would recognize that what was happening on the cross at that very moment was the fulfillment of the prophecy that is written into this psalm. And they would recognize that this was absolutely a God-ordained death of Messiah. It was a way of him indicating, look, this is exactly what was predicted. Keep reading. It becomes more messianic. Verse 8. He trusted on the Lord that he would deliver him. Let him deliver him, seeing he delighteth in him. But thou art he that took me out of the womb. Thou didst make me hope when I was on my mother's breast. I was cast upon thee from the womb. Thou art my God from my mother's belly. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. Many bulls have compassed me. Strong bulls of Bashan have beset me around. They gaped upon me with their mouths as ravening and roaring lions. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted in the midst of my bowels. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws. And thou hast brought me into the dust of death. Very messianic. Things like all my bones are pulled out of their joints. That's a perfect description of crucifixion. You can imagine that if you were hanging by your hands, that your arm joints, your elbows are going to start pulling to the point where they're being yanked from their joints. Well, typically in crucifixion, the way that people would die is they would die from suffocation. Hanging as they did, their heart and their lungs would start collapsing, and whether their feet were nailed or whether they had a small piece of wood to stand on, which you often see depicted in movies and pictures and stuff, that little piece of wood right below their feet, the purpose of that was so that they could push themselves up enough to get a breath and then sink down again as they exhaled. And the lack of ability to pull themselves up that last time would be why they would asphyxiate and why they would suffocate and die. Which is why, in order to speed up the death of any person, they would go out and break their legs. As we're going to see, one of the things that happened when Joseph Arimathea went and begs Pontius Pilate for the body of Jesus is that they send a centurion out to go break the legs to get the bodies off the cross before the high day begins, because the next day is the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and it's a high day. And so they've got to get those bodies down before sundown. So the best way to make sure those bodies are dead is to break their legs, which is why the centurion was amazed when he reached Jesus and Jesus was already dead. The others around there would have still been pushing up and trying to breathe, but Jesus had done exactly as he said. He had the power to lay his life down. And once he gave his life over to God and said, "Into your hands I commend my spirit," he accomplished his own death. And so rather than break his legs, because, very important, a Passover lamb couldn't have any broken bones. That was one of the rules of a Passover lamb. So when they came to break his legs, which would have broken those bones, they found him dead and instead put a spear into his side through his ribs. And there's been a lot of writing and medical writing these days that talk about in asphyxiation that the sac around your heart fills with water. And so once the spear went in between his ribs and pierced his heart sac, that blood and water would have gushed out, which is exactly what the Bible says happened. So his blood ran, but no bone was broken. So he was the perfect type of a Passover lamb. And all of this, according to Psalm 22, was predicted in advance. And so any Jew watching all of this happen would have recognized that David never had his bones all pulled out of joint. And why would David write this unless it was prophetic? Continuing on from verse 15, "My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws, and thou hast brought me into the dust of death." One of the things that Jesus said right toward the end was that he cried out, "I thirst." And so this again would have been a perfect fulfillment of that. Verse 16, "For dogs have compassed me. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me." Look at this. "They pierced my hands and my feet." Now, when did that ever happen to David? Never happened. So clearly he's speaking prophetically of how you would recognize the Messiah. He'd be brought down to death in a way where his bones would be pulled out of joint, where he would be suffering from thirst, and where he would be pierced through in his hands and feet. Verse 17, "I can tell all my bones. I may tell all my bones. They look and they stare upon me." What do your other translations say? Basically, the idea is that your bones are exposed. What?
Well, he says, "I can count all my bones."
I can count all my bones, yeah. That either he's so aware of the pain in every bone as it's being pulled out of joint, or also that the flesh on his body was pulled off to the point where you could see his bones, or that he was so emaciated by the end of the 3 hours of punishment that even in looking at him, his bones would be more apparent than skin at that point.
Maybe possibly that his bones were not broken.
And possibly that his bones were not broken. Yeah, you could count every bone and it would still be intact. Mm-hmm. Verse 18, "They part my garments among them, and they cast lots for my vesture." That's exactly what we read last week, that the Roman centurions, who typically would just divide up the belongings of anybody who had been crucified, Jesus had an expensive, a valuable robe that he wore. And it's described as being seamless, woven all the way through, had no seam in it. And this was not a typical robe. This was an expensive robe that somewhere in the course of his ministry, someone had given him, apparently, and he wore it. And so the Roman centurion saw the value of it. They were going to rip it up and divide it up so everybody could have a piece of this expensive cloth, and then said, "No, let's throw dice for it." This was predicted by David all these years earlier. "They will part my garments among them and cast lots for my vesture. But be not thou far from me, O Lord, O my strength. Haste thee to help me. Deliver my soul from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth. For you have heard me from the horns of the unicorns." What have you got there?
To the wild oxen.
From the wild oxen, yeah, a better translation. My daughter one time asked me, she said, Dad, there's unicorns in the Bible. She said, are those like unicorns? Real unicorns? I said, no, honey, it's probably oxen. I will declare your name unto my brethren in the midst of the congregation. I will praise you. Now, this is really remarkable. It's very typical of Davidic Psalms that he starts out with his complaints, that he starts out by describing how difficult his situation is. But by the end of practically every psalm that David writes, he ends up saying, but God will be praised. He always resorts back to God's sovereignty. We heard it this morning in the psalm that Jeff read, 27, right? David always starts with that, not always, but usually starts with, here's my situation, here's my difficulty, here's my problem, please God help me, please avenge me, please take care of my enemies, my life is difficult, but by the end of every psalm he ends up saying, but your God, praise God. Now if this is a messianic psalm, which it obviously and clearly is, if he is then speaking words that are characteristic of what Jesus would go through on the cross, then he's gone through all this suffering, he's gone through the torment of having the punishment of God poured out on him, but look at the result of it in verse 22. I will declare your name unto whom? Unto my brethren. One more time, even prophetically, the notion that Jesus didn't die for everyone, but at his death would declare his name, the same thing that we saw in John 16, John 17, that we saw Jesus speak of the Holy Spirit that the world would not receive, and that you would know him because he'd be with you and he'd be in you. All of that idea of particularity, unity among the people of God, but particularity of the people of God versus the people of the world. And David even predicted that in verse 22 where he said, I will declare your name unto my brethren. It's not a wide open call to anybody who wants to, but the name of God will be declared by Christ to his people. And in the midst of the congregation, I will praise thee. Ye that fear the Lord, praise him. All ye, the seed of Jacob, glorify him and fear him, all ye, the seed of Israel. For he hath not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, neither hath he hid his face from him. But when he cried unto him, he heard. Now, if that is connected to verse 1, then what David is telling us is that when Christ cried out to God, that God heard him, God did not hate or abhor him, meaning that the punishment that he took had purpose. It wasn't an affliction that God poured on him out of any sort of hatred on God's part or any kind of disdain on God's part. God did this because it was accomplishing the very thing that God in Christ had always intended to accomplish. My praise shall be of thee, verse 25, in the great congregation, I will pay my vows before them that fear him. The meek shall eat and be satisfied. They shall praise the Lord that seek him. Your heart shall live forever. All the ends of the world shall remember and turn unto the Lord, and all the kindreds of the nations shall worship before thee. That's interesting, too, that after David described the crucifixion of Christ, that he started talking about brethren and Jacob and Israel, and by the time he gets done, it's all the kindreds of the earth. So even in David's vision of what Christ would accomplish, it was going to be more than just the salvation of Israel, which was certainly definite and definitive in the language throughout the Old Testament, but just as the promise given to Abraham was that through his seed all the nations of the earth would be blessed, David saw that as being the outgrowth of what Christ did, that all the nations of the earth would have elect among them, and all the ends of the world shall remember and turn unto the Lord, and all the kindreds of the nation shall worship before thee. Verse 28, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he is the governor among the nations. All they that be fat upon earth shall eat and worship. All they that go down to the dust shall bow before him, and none can keep alive his own soul. A seed shall serve him. That's interesting, too. That language of seed goes all the way back to Abraham. Actually, it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, that the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent would always be at enmity with each other. And then the promise of Abraham that he would always have a seed. And then David picks it up in verse 30 and says, a seed shall serve him. Does that mean that everybody on earth will serve him? No, but a seed out of all the nations of the earth will serve him. It shall be accounted to the Lord for a generation. They shall come and shall declare his righteousness unto a people that shall be born, that he hath done this. Now, you can see why, with all of those references, both to his death and ultimately to his resurrection and to his praise and to his glory, you can see why, if Jesus were to have quoted that psalm, especially if he were to have used it as a way of reminding the Jews of everything they knew about David's writing, it would be a way of saying, indicating, look, this is it right now. You're watching it. You are right now seeing the very thing that David wrote about. This psalm is pointing toward me would have been the indication. So that is, again, one of the two views of why Jesus would have said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Either because there was a genuine forsaking going on when God turned away from Christ as he became sin for us, or it could have been an indication on Christ's part to the Jews before him that he was fulfilling Psalm 22. One of those two things, or possibly even both, is true of what happened there. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah.
Perhaps even both?
Why not
both? Yeah. I'm with you, Dave. I kind of hang with both those views for this reason. I do think, obviously, that Psalm 22 is messianic and is pointing toward what Christ would do. And of course, Christ, in saying that, it couldn't help but stir the mind and memory of the Jews that were around the cross at that moment. They couldn't help but catch that indication. However, somebody read Hebrews 18:5. Somebody turn there for a second. When Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's interesting that the writer of Hebrews would pick up that same notion. Have you got it?
Oh, Hebrews what did you say?
No, I don't have it either.
What did I say? Did I say 18:5?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'm probably wrong.
Have the extended version.
I have the extended version. I have the extra chapters. 13:5? Let's see if that's right.
13:5, right.
Exactly. That's precisely what we're looking for. Same word used by the writer of Hebrews to say that we, who are the beneficiaries of the activity that took place on Calvary, we will never have to endure the very thing that Christ endured on our behalf. One more time, a perfect indication that what Christ did on the cross was substitutionary, that he was there taking a punishment that we deserved, and because he took it, we will never have to undergo it. This is a really wonderful, terrific promise on the part of the writer of Hebrews that if you can imagine Christ crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then contrast it to what the writer of Hebrews said in the unextended version in chapter 13, verse 5. You want to read it for us, Dave?
Sure. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you.
Now think about that for a moment. He says that's a promise from God to all those that belong to Christ. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. You have that promise. You can carry that promise around the rest of your life. God has said, I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. Now that's really good news when you're going through those periods of your life that are just really ugly and difficult. Those times in your life when you feel like, where is God? It's good to know that even though you can't always see God in the details of your life, to know that he hasn't forsaken you. He hasn't left you. He's active in what's going on in your life. It's just not as obvious or apparent as we might always like it to be. But more importantly, Christ took God's forsaking, God's punishment, God's wrath, God's turning away, took all of that on your behalf so that you can have the promise that what God did to Christ on the cross will never happen to you.
Well, and it's interesting, he brings it up in the context of just being content, not even some big event, just being content in life.
Yes. The point that he's making in the larger context, Alex, is it's so easy to complain in your life that, okay, I don't have enough or things didn't go my way, where is God? And he's saying, be content with such things as you have because God has not left you and he has not forsaken you, which means what you have at this moment is precisely what God determined you'd have. Therefore, be content. Therefore, recognize that it's not that you came up short or should have worked harder or things turned away, you know? It's not chance and luck. It wasn't just happenstance. God, who has never left you or forsaken you, made sure that this is exactly where you'd be at this moment, and this is how much you would have. Now, if you put that together in the larger context of Pauline theology and all things working together for good, to those that love God, who are the called according to his purpose. Well, then if he's there, never left you and never forsaken you, and everything is working according to his purpose, then what you have and where you are and what's happening in your life is exactly what he ordained for you at this moment. Right? Okay. I see a lot of head nods, but I can't hear the rattling.
Psalm 22. Mm-hmm. When you look at something like verse 27 and 28, do you take that primarily as salvific, or do you take that as millennial?
Read it.
All the families of the nations shall worship before you, and the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. All the prosperous of the earth shall eat and worship.
In those areas where it says he's a governor and he rules over the nations and that kind of stuff, if you're reading it in an Old Testament Israelitish view, the way David originally wrote it, I would have to say that those are kingdom promises. Because when he was here on the planet, did he rule over the nations? How often have I said, Isaiah said, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, right? And the very next thing he says is,
his shoulder will be the government.
And the government shall be upon his shoulders, right? Now, when Jesus was here, did he take up the reins of government?
No.
Oh. But was a child born? Was a son given? Sure. Well, in Isaiah's view, in this is very typical of Old Testament prophets, they'll look at 1,000 years of stuff in one sweeping panorama and say, a child is born, a son is given, the government's on his shoulders. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Prince of Peace, all this stuff. And you say, well, wait, where's that part where he became a governor? Well, that same word comes up in Psalm 22, where it says that he'll be the governor. Prominence over all nations, and they'll all come and worship him. Well, that simply never has happened in any realistic sense. Now, the tendency then is going to be to want to spiritualize those things. The problem I have with that is that there's simply nothing else in Psalm 22 that was not fulfilled in a very physical sense. All that talk of bones being pulled out of their joint. Even if you say Psalm 22, verse 1, that Jesus would literally say these words, well, Jesus did literally say those words. And so everything in that text is literal. I think it just leaps from his crucifixion and his resurrection, like all the Old Testament prophets do, leap straight to kingdom. And that is certainly, let's at least say, that that is certainly the way the original audience would have read it. They wouldn't have known any other way. There wasn't any sort of allegorical method alive at the time. And they had so many other prophetic passages that had to do with future restoration of Israel and kingdom at the return of Messiah. I don't know how they could have read it any other way, right? Now, granted, when we get to the New Testament, the New Testament's going to inform our understanding of all those promises. But I also don't see anything in the New Testament that would make me say that those promises don't continue to be genuine, literal promises of the other things Christ will do, including taking up governorship and ruling over all nations. There's nothing in the text that makes me want to allegorize it. The text is clear on its face, and unless I can find a reason in the text to say that I have to understand it anything other than literal, I'm going to understand it literally, because everything that was fulfilled at Calvary was fulfilled literally the same way it was written literally. Make sense? Because from a hermeneutical standpoint, if you're going to say this was literal, 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 and then it says kingdom, so now we're going to go allegorical on it, I have to find something in the text that makes me do that. And there's simply nothing in the text to make you do that. I can understand in a perfectly literal sense the idea that when Jesus returns, all nations will flow to him. I don't have a problem with that. Did that answer your question? That was a long answer to a short question. But
yeah, and unfortunately, my mind, of course, has to have an argument. And in my mind, I remember what he said to, Pilate, my kingdom. See, I know that people jump on this.
Right, sure. My kingdom's not of this world. How many different ways do you know of, just from listening, does John use the word cosmos?
15.
At least 15, 16 different ways he uses the word cosmos, right? When Jesus came into Jerusalem, they were throwing palm branches and cloaks and stuff in the streets. The Jews said, behold, the world has gone out to meet him. Was it the world?
No.
Chinese people there? American Indians? Was it, right? So you have to recognize that this same word world is used in John 3:16, for God so loved the world. And it's the same word in John 17 when Jesus says, I pray not for the world. It's the same word that John uses in 1 John when he says, don't love the world or the things in it. If you love the world, the love of God's not in you. Same Greek word, cosmos. And so you've got to recognize that world does not always mean absolutely every individual who ever lived without distinction, which is the way it's often assumed in John 3:16. And so when he says, my kingdom is not of this world, which world is he talking about?
Oh, yeah. Boy, I forgot about that application. That's pretty simple.
Which world?
The world system, I guess.
Sure. It's going to be one of those, but you got a lot of choices. You have a lot more choices than just not of this planet.
I should have never figured that out.
You should have been. Yeah. But thanks for taking the 10 minutes out of our day. Yes, sir.
Just a side note on the world, and it's used in John 3:16. I really like B.B. Warfield's sermon on that, where he makes the point that it's not that John's emphasizing that the world was so big that God loved it, but that it was so bad.
Right.
It's almost like we might say, you know, the ghetto, some place that has sort of an ethical connotation of being a place that's, you know, destitute of certain admirable qualities and characteristics. God
and yet he loved
this fallen, depraved place that he gave his only
God. Yep. So. That's good stuff. Yep. All right, we're carrying on back in Matthew. We are in Matthew 27. I'm in verse 47. After Jesus had said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Some of them that stood there, when they heard that, said, this man calls for Elijah. Why would the Jews make that statement? Where would they even get the impression that he would call for Elijah? What would be the point of him calling for Elijah? The very last chapter of the very last book of the Old Testament. The very last word of the Old Testament. Anybody know what the very last word of the Old Testament is?
The end.
The end. Yes, that's what it is. The word end is the last word. No, what's the last word of the Old Testament?
Curse.
It ends with the word curse, which is kind of a dark way to stop or end. The very last chapter says that Elijah will return before the great and terrible day of the Lord. And so to any thoroughgoing Jew, their expectation is that if you are Messiah, Elijah would have come. Where's Elijah? And if this is going to be the great and terrible day of the Lord, and it's all getting dark, and there's earthquakes, and there's rocks shaking and everything else, Elijah's got to show up. It says so at the end of the Old Testament. Not that they would have used the phrase Old Testament, but old to us, same testament to them. But my question is, why would they have even thought that in him crying out to God, it would be a cry for Elijah? Because every Jew's expectation was the return of Elijah. To this day, I don't know if you have any Orthodox Jewish friends, but a truly Orthodox Jew, when they sit down to eat any of the feasts, leave an empty chair and an empty plate for Elijah, because their expectation is that he's going to come back before the Messiah comes and establishes the kingdom and all the other promises will come true. So there is this Elijah expectation, and that's probably the basis of why they would say, look, he's calling for Elijah. The lack of Elijah showing up would continue to convince them that they were just crucifying a man and not the Son of God, and therefore, since neither God or an angel or Elijah came to help him, he's clearly not the Messiah, so we're off the hook. And straightway, one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink. And the rest said, let be. Let us see whether Elijah will come to save him. Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in half from the top to the bottom. The earth did quake, and the rocks were broken. Now think about that for a moment. 3 hours of darkness. He cries out with a loud voice, earthquake, rocks breaking. This was an absolutely traumatic event. Anybody in that area of the world would be very keenly aware of all the activity going on outside the wall, right outside the wall. Remember, they said that the place where he was crucified was close by, right outside the wall. This is not out in the middle of a desert somewhere. This is a very known place where he's being crucified, and all of the darkness and the earthquakes and the rocks breaking, and then the very people who are responsible for him go into the temple, and this curtain, and there's been a lot of history written about this curtain. What have you got in your Bibles? Any notes about the thickness of the curtain? Because it was woven in several layers until it was 6-8 inches deep. It was woven through multiple layers, so it was a very big, heavy, thick curtain. And importantly, as Matthew points out, it wasn't torn from the bottom up or cut with scissors or sliced with knives. It was ripped from the top to the bottom, showing that God ripped open the doorway into the Holy of Holies. And this is really, really important because the Hebrew history of the Holy of Holies is that that's the place where the high priest would go once a year with the appropriate sacrifice, a blood sacrifice from a spotless animal. He would go in once a year on the Feast of Atonement to atone for sin. He would atone for particular people's sin. This is very, very important. When the high priest went into the Holy of Holies once a year, he had a breastplate with 12 precious jewels on it with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel written on it. But then he also had these shoulder pads that had stones built into it with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel on it. So when the high priest went into the Holy of Holies every year, he was going in interceding for particular people because the high priest's job was always to intercede for particular people. Once a year, pardon me?
He didn't go in for the Babylonians.
No, he didn't go in there for the Egyptians. Not only did they have no high priest or atonement, they didn't even know what the method was. God didn't bother to tell them what the method was. The covenant he made was with Israel, particular people, whom he called Israel, my chosen, Jacob, mine elect. God's electing grace was on these people in showing them, this is what I expect, this is how it is done, this is how you will atone, this is how you'll do the blood sacrifice, this is how you'll do the scapegoat, this is how you lay the hands on, this is how you take one goat outside the camp, this is how you take the other one, you slice its neck open, you bring the blood in, you pour it on the kapporeth on top of the Ark of the Covenant, inside which is the covenant that I made with you, particular people. The mistake people make is that they think that when Jesus is spoken of as a high priest, that suddenly he goes from being a high priest to particular people, which the office of high priest has always been to particular people, that somehow Jesus came along and became the high priest for absolutely everybody. But that's never the way a high priest worked. So once a year, Feast of Atonement, high priest, proper sacrifice with blood on the kapporeth, on the covenant, once a year into the Holy of Holies. But the Holy of Holies that was inside Herod's temple was missing one very important piece of furniture, the Ark of the Covenant. There was no Ark of the Covenant in that Holy of Holies, nor had God's presence as a cloud which had descended and filled the tabernacle in the wilderness. Once they had built it and they sanctified it, God's presence was made known there. In Solomon's temple, God's presence was made known there. But in Herod's temple, there's no history of God's presence ever showing up there. And since the time of Jeremiah, the furniture for the temple, and particularly the Ark of the Covenant, has disappeared, hasn't been found since, until it was found by Steven Spielberg. But up until then, unknown. And we know where it is now. It's in a big warehouse, in a crate, stored somewhere near Washington.
Thank you, Steven.
Thank you, Steven. By the way, next time you watch that movie, Stephen got it wrong. And you would think Steve, being a Jew, would have gotten it right. But do you remember what he said was inside the Ark of the Covenant? It's explained for us by Indiana Jones. He says that the broken pieces of the Ten Commandments, when Moses broke it, that those pieces were picked up and put inside the Ark. Huge error. Enormous mistake. I was sitting watching the movie when it first came out, and I remember turning to my friend and going, wrong. It's not what happened. You'd think you'd get that right. No, the first covenant made by God, cut with God's own finger, and then God wrote the Ten Commandments on it and gave those tablets to Moses. Moses came down off the mountain, saw the children of Israel dancing naked around a golden calf, and in his anger and in his temper threw those stones down on the calf, goes back up, repents in front of God, says, blot me out. I've clearly made a big error here. I just took the stones that you made and just threw them down and broke them. Okay. And God says, no, I'll say who sinned in this one. And then he tells Moses to do something different. God doesn't go cut out the stone of the second covenant, because remember, the first covenant was broken because of sin and idolatry. Instead, he says, go cut out two tablets and bring them to me. This time, it's a covenant cut in a man, and a man does the cutting of the stone, brings it to God, and God writes on it. And that second covenant, which is a type of Christ, is kept intact and put inside the Ark of the Covenant. Mm. What else is inside the Ark of the Covenant?
Aaron's rod and
Aaron's rod that budded. What does that bespeak?
Resurrection.
Resurrection, yes. And what else is in there?
Manna.
There's a golden cup with manna inside it. And what does Jesus say? I am that bread that came from heaven. So you've got three types inside the Ark of the Covenant, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You've got the Holy Spirit in Aaron's rod that budded, because that's resurrection power. You've got God's covenant, made in stone, cut in a man. And then you've got the bread from heaven, that Christ himself said, I am that bread. You've got all of that inside what is called the Ark of the Covenant, with a lid on top of it called the kapprith, or the covering. And the blood every year was spilled on that covering. Now, according to the writer of Hebrews, he said Jesus did not enter into that tabernacle that was made with hands, which is a type of the things of heaven, but entered into the tabernacle in heaven, and there he made his sacrifice. So he, as our high priest, went before God into God's temple with the sacrifice price of his own blood. And he finally gave fulfillment to all the type and shadow that for 1,400 years had been going on inside the Holy of Holies. So once Christ died, was there any more purpose or reason for the holiest place? No, the holiest place was ripped open, not to let God out, but to let us in. Because all of those types and shadows were finished, done with. So what did the Jews do?
Sew it back up.
Exactly right. So caught up in their tradition that even walking into the temple and finding the curtain torn open, got out the needle and thread and said, we got to get to work sewing this back up and keeping our tradition alive. But to anybody who understood what had happened, there was no more point to animal sacrifice. The book of Hebrews goes on and on about this, that there is now a better mediator who has better promises and a better covenant in the new covenant, who had a better sacrifice, because all those animals brought before God continually could never perfect anybody. If they ever had, the writer of Hebrews says, they would have stopped doing it because it would have accomplished what it was meant to accomplish. But Christ, by his once-for-all sacrifice, sat down at the right hand of God because he had perfected forever those that are sanctified, set aside for God's use. So again, even at the point of Christ's death, he's continuing to teach. He's continuing to teach this same theology over and over, which is the prominence of Christ in all things, and the curtain is ripped open, and the way to the Holy of Holies is now made manifest to everybody. It's no longer through the sacrifice of animals or through the kapparith and the Ark of the Covenant that wasn't even in there anymore. The way to God is now obvious. It's through Christ, and there is no other approach. I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And so there's a lot of significance to that curtain being yanked open that way. Verse 52 says, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many. Put flesh and blood on that for a moment. Well, I assume they did have flesh and blood when they got up. Christ being the first fruit of the resurrection, it says that when he resurrected, many of the bodies of the saints that slept got up out of their graves and went into the city. That's frightening. Now, by the way, we just have to throw this out here, and we can speculate all we want because there's no biblical answer, but where'd those people go? Did they die again?
No.
Could they die again? No, they had resurrected bodies. Where did those people go? I want to know these things. I have a lot of questions.
Yeah,
when we get to heaven, I want the first couple thousand years just to ask questions. Where did those people go? They clearly couldn't die, which means they went to heaven, right? But when and how? And where did they go and when did they go? And
did they have glorified body before Jesus did?
No, it says after his resurrection, they came out of the grave. Look, they came out of the grave after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many.
But was he glorified immediately after his resurrection? Or he waited? Right?
Oh, no. He was glorified at his resurrection, yes.
Stephen went to touch him. No, Stephen.
Okay, you're getting into two different subjects. Hang on for 1 second. Because what you're asking about is this. When Mary came to the tomb, and we're just jumping ahead slightly here, when Mary came to the tomb and thought he was the gardener, it means that he somehow cloaked his true being from her, very much as he did with the apostles who were walking on the Emmaus Road. So Mary thinks he's the gardener and says, where have you taken his body? Because she's come there to thinking he's still dead, going to anoint the body, which was typical, 3 days, three nights. Jews would then go and anoint the body because it was dead. And he said to her, Mary, she recognizes who he is, and he says, don't touch me. I haven't yet ascended to the Father. Within days, he shows up and says to Thomas, appears in a locked room, and says to Thomas, touch me. Right? So where's he been? He's been to the Father.
He still has wounds.
But he still has the wounds in his glorified body, but it is the glorified body. So you were asking about, does he have a glorified body? I think from the moment he raised from the grave and said to Mary, don't touch me, it's because he was absolutely pure and he couldn't touch any sinful thing. Any dirty thing, any human sinful thing couldn't be touched. I didn't mean to point at you. I was making reference to what you had said earlier.
Right.
I did.
It was an appropriate gesture.
And so don't touch me. I can't be touched by any earthly sinful thing. And yet then he turns around and says to Thomas, here, touch me. So clearly something changed. He'd been to the Father. He'd made the sacrifice. He had completed the transaction. Right? So then would they have glorified bodies when they resurrected? I'm prone to say yes. You know, something dramatic happened there. So could they die again? I'm tempted to say no. And if no, where'd they go? I have questions.
On the other hand, when Lazarus was raised, you felt that he also had a glorified body?
The only reason I would say that Lazarus did not have a glorified body is this. Paul said that Jesus was the first fruit of the resurrection.
Oh, right.
And if anybody could have had a resurrection that resulted in a glorified body prior to Christ, Christ wasn't the first fruit, Lazarus was.
Right.
But if there's a resurrection after Jesus' resurrection, I'm more prone to say, well, that's a different kind of resurrection than what happened to Lazarus. But again, I'm speculating. Verse 54, now when the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, truly this was the Son of God. And many women were there, beholding afar off, which followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering unto him, among which was Mary Magdalene, and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's children, which would have been who? Who were Zebedee's children? Zebedee was the father of? James and John. Yep. So when even was come, verse 57, when the evening was come, which would have started, now this is really important to get into your heads, and maybe next week we'll take a little more time and do it. Go to the website. On the Q&A section, there is something called, it's a chart. What did we call it? Passion Week chart. It's called the Passion Week chart. That's what it is. You can go and have a look at it. It's important to understand, again, this is Matthew, very Jewish writer. It's important to understand the days of the week that are ticking off during this time that Jesus was crucified and when he raised. The next day after the day of Passover, and had been for 1,400 years, the day after, the 15th of the month of Nisan, was the first day of a week-long feast called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the first and the seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread were high days. They were holy days. They were also called Sabbaths. And so when you read in John's account of it, of them going and begging for the body of Jesus and that they needed to get it off the cross, he says, because the next day was an high day, which we know historically it was. It was the first day of the week-long Feast of Unleavened Bread. So regardless of what day of the week it was, that day, the end of that day, the end of Passover day, leads into a high day. So it was an absolute necessity to get those bodies off the cross. You understand that? So when evening was come, there was a rich man of Arimathea named Joseph, who also himself was Jesus' disciple. He went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded that the body would be delivered. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and he laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher and departed. And there was Mary Magdalene and the other Mary sitting over against the sepulcher. All of that is very important because that means that not only was Jesus crucified in a very known, recognizable place right outside the city walls, but that between the time that the sun was coming down, it was the evening, and before night fell, they had to get that body down and get it into a grave, which means the grave had to be very, very close by the place where the crucifixion took place. There wasn't time to move the body very far. It was so close, in fact, that Mary and Mary Magdalene were able to walk to where the sepulcher was and watch where they put the body, which is how they were able to come back to that same place later with their spices to embalm the body. It's very important to know that it was in a known, accessible tomb. The reason that's important is that so many theories against the resurrection start with the idea that the women mistakenly went to the wrong tomb. And somehow the disciples and everybody were just confused about where the tomb was, where the body was laid. But it had to be a very known, accessible tomb because it was owned by a rich man in the area who would know where his own empty tomb was. It's very close proximity to the place where he was crucified, which is right outside the city walls. And so as you approach theories that try to explain the resurrection in humanistic terms, it's important to know that that place where his body was very close, very known, very accessible. The wrong tomb theory just can't fly. Now, we're going to talk about verse 62, and then we're going to call it a morning, okay? Do we all understand and agree that when you're reading any translation of the Bible, the punctuation is added by the translators? Are you with me so far? Okay. Most of the earliest manuscripts are what are called uncial text. It's all capital Greek letters, usually kind of run together, sometimes with small markings telling you where the beginning of sentences or paragraphs would be. But everything you see in terms of punctuation is added by translators for readability. I am going to move a comma in verse 62, and in so doing, change the entire meaning of the verse. Now, the next day that followed the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees came together unto Pilate. Now, this is very interesting. This is where we get the Friday to Sunday theory. This is where we get the idea that Jesus died on a Friday, because Friday is the weekly day of preparation. And so if the next day that followed the day of preparation is the Sabbath, Saturday, which it always is, and if Jesus raised before sunup on Sunday, which we're clearly told he did, well, then Jesus went into the grave Friday evening at nightfall, was in the grave from Friday night to Saturday night, and before Sunday morning was out of the grave. And that whole structure, which has been foisted on the Christian church for years and years and years, is based on that verse. However, nowhere in the New Testament or Old Testament, anywhere, is the day after the day of preparation called the day after the day of preparation. What's it always called? The Sabbath. It's the most important day of the week. It's the sign of Israel's covenant. It is always called the Sabbath. You understand? So we're talking about the day after the day that they took Jesus' body off the cross. If I move the comma so that it reads like this, now the next day that followed, comma, the day of preparation, comma, the chief priests and Pharisees came to see Pilate. Now if we read it the original way, the next day that followed the day of preparation, that means it's the Sabbath and the chief priests went to talk to Pilate on the Sabbath. What's wrong with that picture? They're not allowed to do it. They can't do it. They can't leave the temple and they can't leave their homes on the Sabbath to go talk to Pilate. So why were they in a big hurry to get to Pilate? What was it that they were worried about? They were worried about getting a guard onto that tomb because they knew that Jesus had said on the third day he would rise again. But if you just put him in the grave the night before and you know that Jesus said 3 days and three nights the Son of Man will be in the belly of the earth. 3 days, three nights. I don't care how hard you work. You can't get three nights from Friday night to Sunday morning. So either Jesus didn't understand math, or we have misunderstood that verse. And by the way, you can every Easter, you're going to hear this bandied about again, and Easter's coming, and everyone's going to argue about how Sunday, you know, Sunday morning, that's part of a day. All of Saturday, that's a day. Friday night he was in the grave, that's part of a day. But by Jewish reckoning, which goes from sundown to sundown, when he was in the grave at sundown Friday, that's the beginning of the first day. So he was in for a night Friday night. He was in all day Saturday. He was in for a night. There it is. He's out. You've got two nights in a day, best. in that scenario. And it all comes from a misreading of this. The reality is it says that the next day that followed, comma, the day of preparation, they went and talked to Pilate about getting a guard. Why did they want a guard on the tomb? Why didn't they do it themselves? Because they went and talked on the day of preparation, and the next day was the Sabbath when they couldn't leave their homes, so they couldn't go guard the tomb, so they had to have Roman guards over there guarding the tomb.
He was crucified on Wednesday.
Absolutely. He was crucified on a Wednesday, the 14th of Nisan. There's no other way to work it. And Wednesday night, the beginning of Thursday, he was in the tomb. That was the high day, the first day of the 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. He was in the tomb from Wednesday night to Thursday night, Thursday night to Friday night, Friday night to Saturday night. Saturday night is the beginning of the first day of the week. And it says, as the day was dawning, while it was still dark, the women came to the tomb. Did they find him getting up?
Nope.
No, they found an empty tomb. He got up before sunrise on Sunday. So don't go to sunrise service. That's Babylonian sun worship. That's the Ishtar feast. So my point is, Wednesday night to Thursday night to Friday night, Friday night to Saturday night, and then he gets up. That's 72 hours. That's 3 days, three nights. And it leaves you room on the second day. The high day happens first, so they got to get the body down. On the second day, which is a day of preparation, which would be a Friday, that gives them time to go and talk about, we need a guard. And then they can't go guard the tomb on the third day, which is the Sabbath, and so they've got the Roman guard on there. And as soon as the day is dawning, Saturday night, Sunday morning, they're off to the tomb because they couldn't go before then because it was the Sabbath. So that, by the way, is all laid out in the Passion Week chart on our website with all the scriptural proofs where you can go through it day by day and see all the things that took place in each of those days. It is not original to me. I started with Scroggie's Guide to the Gospels, where he lays it out. I took it and expanded it from there. None of this is original to me and, in fact, has a long, long history in the church. The most common view of Jesus' resurrection has always been, or of his death, burial, and resurrection, has always been in the early church and in the earliest documents that it was either a Wednesday or a Thursday that he died. He definitely got up at the dawning of the first day of the week, we know that. To get 3 days and three nights, 72 hours, you have to go back to Wednesday, which leaves room for everything the gospel says happened. But there's no way to read verse 62, now, the next day that followed the day of preparation, because the day that follows the day of preparation is the Sabbath, and there's no way that the high priest on the Sabbath could go and talk to a Gentile.
It should be Good Wednesday.
We should what?
Good Wednesday.
It should be Good Wednesday. Well, Good Friday, we're done here, by the way. Good Friday comes from the fact that Friday is Freya's day, the fish god.
That's where it comes from?
Yes, of course. Well, all Moon Day, Tammuz Day, Woden's Day, Thor's Day, Freya's Day, Saturn Day, and then the day of the sun, the Sunday. You don't find any of that in the Bible. You find first day, second day, third day, fourth day, Sabbath. And all of those heathen names of months and days and stuff were imposed on it. Now, in the Ishtar feast, on Freya's Day, they wouldn't eat meat, and so they would only eat the fish.
That's where the Catholics got
it? Sure, of course. And so they would only eat fish on Freya's Day. And all of us who grew up in the 60s and 70s remember that if you ate at the school cafeteria, you couldn't get meat on Friday. I grew up in Detroit with a lot of Catholics. You couldn't get anything but fish. I didn't like fish. Fish sticks, exactly, but that qualifies. And then a later pope came along and said, you know what, that whole fish thing on Fridays, nah, and they broke that rule. And I'm sure that there's some guy in hell to this day doing time on an old meat wrap, who's probably really upset that a later pope said, okay, you can't eat meat. Oh, yeah. So without confusing the issue, the Friday, Saturday, Sunday thing was around before Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. The Friday, Saturday, Sunday thing was all part of Babylonish Ishtar worship, starting on Freya's day and going to the day of the sun, when they would all go out at sunrise and worship the rising of the sun. It's just all been imposed on Christianity, and without going too deep into all of that, the Bible doesn't support any of that. The Bible supports a Wednesday crucifixion and a Saturday night before Sunday morning resurrection, 72 actual hours. And so I'm going to go with the Bible, and even though that upsets people's traditions, that's my job. I yank rugs out from people's traditions.
What day did the bunny come out of the egg?
Part of the Ishtar feast, part and parcel of the whole Ishtar thing, was that it was a spring Bacchanalia feast to fertility. So, okay, fertility feast. What would be the two emblems of fertility that would be most popular?
Bunnies and eggs.
Rabbits and eggs. Hello, fertility. Right?
Yeah.
I don't even like the name Easter. By the way, you know, in the King James Version, the word Easter is in there, and it's a translation of the word Passover. It's unbelievable that they, because Easter was so entrenched, felt that it was necessary to stick it in the Bible somewhere and mistranslated the word Passover so that they could get Easter in there. But I could rail forever about my problems with those kind of holidays. Let's go back to what the Bible says, and let's just follow the Bible, and it will be okay.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.